sports fans in Boston do not need to spend this New Year's Day watching football because they have an alternative at Boston's Fenway Park. The old baseball stadium will be hosting an outdoor hockey game. Gemma Hooley spent some time watching preparations for the Winter Classic.
Dan Craig is the National Hockey League's Iceman. For the last couple of weeks, he and his crew have been turning the green grass of Fenway Park into a perfect sheet of ice.
Ask Moff where there might be a squeegee and grab one of the guys and put some pretty good water down here. See this air pocket here? Well, all that will happen is they'll turn white, they'll just turn into frost if we don't get the water right through it.
Staging this matchup between the Bruins and the Flyers took 20,000 gallons of water, 3,000 gallons of coolant, and 350 gallons of white paint. And if patience came in gallons, there'd be thousands of those too. Craig's son Mike is on a 9-man crew spraying water to build ice.
Basically, you want to build layers and build it thin so each layer has a chance to bond to the layer below it, and you build a solid, thick, dense sheet that way. It takes a very long time. You have to be very patient.
Beneath the ice is a whole system for protecting Fenway's grass. It looks like geologic layers in a science project. Tarp, styrofoam, plywood, then thousands of pieces of decking locked together like a giant jigsaw puzzle. To make ice panels, there's a labyrinth of cooling pipes inside huge metal refrigeration pans. The pipes run through the stadium and out onto the street where they're connected to a refrigeration truck.
You're basically standing in a refrigeration engine room.
Engineer Richard Beer and his team constantly adjust the ice temperature.
Step over here, I'll show you something. The NHL has asked for a 25-degree set point, okay? Now, right now, we're 17 degrees. That's in part to do with the wind chill, okay? So we're way below temperature. This machine will not start until we get about 25 degrees, about a half a degree above set point, and this machine comes online.
While the ice crew freezes water on the rink, Don Renzulli is trying to figure out how to unfreeze water in Fenway Park's plumbing system.
These buildings are not winterized. It's like a summer house on the lake. You close it up and go away.
Renzulli heads up events for the Hockey League. He has to get this near-century-old summer stadium ready for 37,000 fans in the middle of winter. So aside from juggling TV crews, pyrotechnics, video boards, and plane flyovers, he also has a long list of seasonal worries.
How do we pour soda and water and beer? How can we move product around come game day? People just show up and they think it's going to be a cold beer. Bathrooms are going to have water.
Meanwhile, Dan Craig is checking the weather forecast more often than a sailor on the high seas. He can outwit Mother Nature's thermostat with refrigeration techniques, but he can't control what comes from the skies.
We get the wind, the air temperature, Doppler radar. We know what's coming up. We know where everything's going. And we have a system in the ice surface so I can read below the surface, on top of the surface, air temperature, humidity, and it updates every 15 minutes.
Craig promised Fenway Park that after the game, he'd leave everything as he found it. That when the last of the ice melted on the infield, it would be like hockey had never been there at all. For NPR News, I'm Gemma Hooley.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep, and if you don't mind, we'd like to stretch your mind just a little bit on this New Year's morning. We're going to report on the possibility of a change in the uneasy relationship between religion and science. Novelist Margaret Atwood is known for her literary science fiction, and she thinks that in the future we could see a religion that combines religion and science. To understand the prospects for that idea, you could begin with a scholar who's looked at the past. Rick Kleffel reports from member station KUSP.
Karen Armstrong is a religious scholar who has studied the history of belief. In her latest book, The Case for God, she looks at the relationship between science and religion. The current conflict between the two, with Darwin's theory of evolution as a flashpoint, is not in keeping with historical interpretations of Scripture.
Darwin came along and found a natural explanation for life itself. Now, this wouldn't have been a big deal. In the past, St. Augustine had laid down an important principle and said that if a scriptural text contradicts science, you must give it an allegorical interpretation.
Armstrong is looking at lessons of the past, while Margaret Atwood extrapolates from the past to create a vision of the future. One of Atwood's best-known novels, adapted into a movie, is The Handmaid's Tale, set in the future in which America has become a Christian fundamentalist theocracy. Atwood believes that science fiction became necessary when the contradictions between objective reality and religious orthodoxy became too difficult to ignore.
Those things that we used to just believe in all the time went to Planet X, where they are alive and well. Angels with flaming swords, the burning bush that speaks, you know, all of those really quite science fiction things in the Bible.
Karen Armstrong says her research into the history of religion demonstrates that science and religion are two very different kinds of knowledge.
Religion is not answering our scientific questions about how did the world come into being. That's a question for science. Religion is asking us to consider these problems that always occur to human beings. Why is life so filled with pain? What is the nature of happiness? What is the meaning of our mortality?
Armstrong sees the role of religion as a guiding force for ethical behavior. Margaret Atwood brings that notion to life in her newest novel, The Year of the Flood. It's set in a dystopian near future where genetic engineering has ravaged much of the planet. The survivors have created a new religion.
This group, which is called the God's Gardeners, has taken it possibly to an extreme that not everybody will be able to do. They live on rooftops in slums on which they have vegetable gardens and they keep bees. And they are strictly vegetarian unless you get really, really hungry, in which case you have to start at the bottom of the food chain and work up. And they make everything out of recycled cast-offs and junk. So they're quite strict.
Atwood points out that the beginnings of her religion of the future have already appeared in the present.
Indeed, we now have the Green Bible among us, which I did not know when I was writing this book, which has tasteful linen covers, ecologically correct paper, the green parts in green, introduction by Archbishop Tutu, and a list at the end of useful things you can do to be a more worthy green person.
Atwood created a new pantheon of saints, including Rachel Carson, Al Gore, and Diane Fossey, the murdered conservationist, as well as hymns, which have been brought to life by Orville Stober.
Today we praise our Saint Diane, whose blood for bounteous life was spilled. Although she interposed her faith, one species more was killed.
Atwood's environmentally based religion gets to the core of Armstrong's understanding of faith.
The creation story was therapeutic. It was telling us how to be creative ourselves and indeed to keep the cosmos in balance. Men and women and gods had to work together to keep this fragile ecostructure together.
Karen Armstrong's philosophical ecosystem is reflected in Atwood's futuristic religion. But even though God's Gardeners feels like a real religion, Margaret Atwood is not ready to step up to the pulpit.
Well, not quite in the same way that L. Ron Hubbard did. I don't have any adherence yet, but who knows?
For NPR News, I'm Rick Kleffel.
And you can read Karen Armstrong and Margaret Atwood at NPR.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. This week, we've heard a couple of writers talk about the movies that were made from their books. John Ronson, who wrote The Men Who Stare at Goats, and Walter Kern, who wrote Up in the Air. Well, today, our third and final interview is about a more faithful movie adaptation, the film made from Lynn Barber's memoir, An Education. Barber wrote the story of her affair when she was in high school with an older man, in fact, an older con man. Barber wrote of spending weekdays prepping for Oxford and weekends flying off to European cities with her lover.
Action is character, our English teacher says. I think it means that if we never did anything, we wouldn't be anybody. And I never did anything before I met you.
In the movie, Lynn Barber's character is played by Carey Mulligan. Her lover is played by Peter Sarsgaard. The screenplay for An Education was written by the English novelist and screenwriter Nick Hornby.
I'm incredibly happy with the movie, and I think I'm a very lucky bunny to have had Nick Hornby write it. And he's made my story, which is a bit sort of prickly, he's made it more acceptable, I think. He's made all the characters just slightly nicer than they are in my version. And he's had some wonderful sort of flights of humour where there was just a sort of tiny little phrase of mine which he's expanded into whole funny scenes, and I really admire that.
One of the oddest little changes in the adaptation that you've written about was changing the year of the story. It was in 1960 that you had this affair, to 1961.
Yes, I was very interested in that. And in fact, the production designer and the producer explained it to me. And in 1960, England, to all intents and purposes, looked exactly the same as England in the 1950s. It was incredibly drab. There was a lot of bomb damage. There was no glimmer of fashion in the streets, whereas in 1961, you're just beginning to get the birth of the 60s. I mean, still not really, but... And I think the art director told me that you got more coloured cars in 1961, and that before that, a street would have entirely consisted of dark green and black, dull-looking cars, and it would have just looked dull and drab, you know.
In the film, you, as a teenager, play the cello. This is completely in the movie. It has nothing to do with your actual story.
Absolutely. I can't play any musical instrument at all. So I was quite surprised to find myself turning into a competent cellist. I think maybe Nick Hornby played the cello at some point. And also he created the first scene. The con man picks up the schoolgirl. He drives his car along and says, "You mustn't let your cello get wet. Let me give your cello a lift." And in my book, I'd just accepted a lift from a stranger. And Nick said, "Well, that makes you look like a very bad girl indeed, you know." And by having this sort of flim-flam of he's giving the cello a lift, therefore that's an excuse for me to get into the car, therefore it's all it's all more likeable again.
How does the older man in the movie compare with the real character from your life?
I think Nick has sweetened him, made him less sleazy, really, than he was in real life. But this was something Nick talked to me about right at the beginning. He said we can't present him as a total con man because people wouldn't like to watch a film in which a nice young girl fell in love with a horrible, sleazy con man. So he's got to be nicer than, you know, in my book.
Why is it that we can easily read an account of people who are not nice and people who have extremely rough edges, but it's assumed that when we're captive inside a movie theater, we can't stand watching them?
I know, but apparently that is the case. I mean, it's the same principle that they have to be prettier than they would be in real life, don't they? They have to be, and the settings have to be nicer, and, you know, you have to have some visual pleasures, and character pleasures include watching nice people. Well, nicer. I mean, actually, you know, he still turns out to be a con man, but nicer than in my book.
Well, by the time that you saw the film, did you feel, "I'm now looking at my story on the screen," or were you looking at Nick Hornby's story on the screen?
Yes,
or the director's
more Nick
story?
Hornby's. And by the time I actually saw the film, I'd put it in the contract that I'd got to see every draft of the script and comment on it. And sometimes if I didn't like something, Nick would change it, you know. And so I was pretty familiar with the script by the time I saw the film. And it no longer really felt like my story. I was actually thinking, "Oh, how will it end? What happens?" You know? And I thought, "Gosh, I should know that by now."
but was it a no lose situation? That is, did you walk in saying, "If this movie is really good, it's a wonderful movie associated with me," and if
yes.
it isn't, what did I have to do with it? I just
exactly. I felt very lucky from that point of view. What I'd feared was that he might coarsen it slightly or give it a sort of Lolita-ish tinge where there was a sort of relish for the fact that there were schoolgirls getting undressed, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in fact, he totally, totally didn't. And also by having a woman director, they sort of ensured that that wouldn't happen. But that was my one fear.
How do you deal with the idea that, although you're a very successful journalist and people have been reading you in Britain and elsewhere for years, and your book is going to be published in the U.S. now, the number of people who will see a film is just so large that that's you. That for people who don't know you, Carey Mulligan in An Education, that's you. That's Lynn Barber.
Yes. Well, that's quite... Yeah, no, that's quite an attractive thought, actually. The only sort of other side of that is that among people who do know me, I do get a bit agitated if they keep saying how much they like the film and they don't say, I like the book. And the people I like most are those who say they like the film, but of course they still love the book more. So that's a bit of a test. But yes, I mean, the idea that, I don't know, in Bangkok or something, that they would form an idea of Lynn Barber.
Yes. Oh, Lynn Barber, yes, Lynn Barber, I remember.
Yeah, that's been
she
odd.
Played the cello as a kid and had an affair with Peter Sarsgaard.
Well, I suppose it is strange, but anyway, it's all good fun, actually.
Lynn Barber, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Lynn Barber's book, An Education, will be published in the States next month. It is the basis for the film, An Education. The arrest of Charlie Sheen on Christmas Day has all the makings of the next big celebrity scandal. He's the star of a hugely popular TV show, and he's accused of threatening his wife with a knife. But commentator Andrew Wallenstein says he's still waiting for an appropriate show of public indignation.
2009 saw scandal after scandal. Tiger Woods, David Letterman, Governor Mark Sanford. But why did their exploits merit such great hue and cry while Sheen draws yawns? You can't question Charlie Sheen's stardom credentials. He's television's highest paid actor. Maybe there's no tiger-sized media circus because the actor isn't being accused of cheating on his wife. Of course, she says he pulled a knife on her in the heat of an argument. Apparently that's a lesser sin than infidelity. Or maybe it was the timing of that sin. You see, if you're a celebrity considering committing a heinous crime, Christmas is a great time to do it. The media can't quite muster its usual frenzy when it's sleeping off all that eggnog. So why is Sheen's considerable controversy no big deal? Two reasons. One, we've come to expect this from him. This guy has a well-documented laundry list of sleazy misdeeds dating back to the early 1990s. When your name shows up on Heidi Fleiss's client list, you know you've made something of yourself. But Sheen's lengthy rap sheet makes the media firestorms enveloping Woods and Company all the more peculiar. Shouldn't we save our high dudgeon for chronic miscreants like Sheen instead of less prolific wrongdoers like Letterman or Sanford? The second reason is that Sheen not only is a dirtbag, but he plays one on TV.
Smart women, foolish choices. Thank God for those gals.
The role he's most famous for, on CBS's 2 1/2 Men, he's basically playing himself. A smarmy rake.
I'm just saying that when someone freely gives you her cupcake, your only obligation is to enjoy it. There's no reason to get emotionally involved.
Why not?
Because if you do, the next thing you know, you'll be stuck eating the same damn cupcake for the rest of your life.
Woods and Sanford got roasted because they projected images of disciplined family men. Sheen doesn't bother with that. And if the blurring of his real and fictional personas hasn't lulled the public into giving him a pass, then the frequency of his bad behavior surely has. But we're better than this, America. So let's all make a resolution in the new year to exercise a more rational morality in our celebrity worship.
Andrew Wallenstein is an editor for The Hollywood Reporter.